Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is 9/04/2002. This session is I Gave It to God, But It Came Back. Your presenter is Dr. Nancy C. Reeves, REN 2002-08. Why don't we listen in?
My name is Nancy Reeves, and this series is Found Through Loss, Healing Stories from Scripture and Everyday Sacredness. And tonight we are focusing on stuck or unresolved grief. There's a lot of chairs over here. So if you want to throw it. Right. Yeah, a whole bunch over here. So for those of you who have not been here before, the first evening we focused on the grieving process, and we talked about how loss is any experience that we feel restricts us in some way, and so that can be bereavement or a chronic illness or accident, moving, loss of a dream, loss of culture, loss of faith, and that we grieve for the meanings and the implications of a loss, not just the fact of a loss. So you can't look at, say, the death of a parent and say, okay, somebody's gonna grieve this length and this depth because this is of this type of loss. There's so many different factors in that. And that grieving is a healing process. It's the way we understand what meanings and implications are connected to this unwanted experience. And by allowing the pain of grief, we get to become more aware of what our needs are and open to God's healing, transforming love. And the second session, we looked at trauma, loss with the volume turned way up, something that just we don't want to fit in our worldview, so torture or murder or terrorist acts, some kind of destruction and violence. And we talked about the different reactions to trauma that people have. Tonight we're focusing on stuck or unresolved grief. Tomorrow we're going to look at tools for healing that we can use for ourselves and for others. And on the last evening we're going to look at rituals that we can do for any kind of loss to help with that process. Each evening I've started with a prayer. Tonight it's one called In Difficult Times by Sister Joyce Rupp from her book Out of the Ordinary. So let us pray. Consoling God, be a source of serenity for me when struggles and difficulties threaten to overwhelm me. God of hope, assure me of your unconditional love when I doubt myself or question the worth of my life. Truth-bringing God, encourage me to embrace you during those times when I get lost in the lies of my weakness. Compassionate God, hold me to your heart when I feel helpless in the face of the world's pain. Light-filled God, keep me ever close to you during those moments when bleakness surrounds my life. Comforting God, shelter me under your wings when I am engulfed in sadness and overcome with distress. God of peace, you are the center of my life, a strong refuge of peace in the whirlwind of my pain. I look to you for strength and a constant assurance of hope. With your Son, Jesus Christ, and in the Holy Spirit, I pray. Amen. So, sometimes the grieving process, although it hurts a whole lot, seems to resolve itself. It moves through. The sharp pain moves off. We start to reach out to life again. We have energy to to live, not just exist, but sometimes it seems we can't let go for some reason. And I just want to talk about some of those reasons and tell some stories about how God reaches out to us at those times. So the first one, Tom, if you could just move down. One reason for unresolved or stuck grief. Hi, you got tears. Here. Sorry. No problem. Come on in. We still got a few here and a few here. Hit the button somewhere. Excuse me. Is that we are unwilling to move into the pain of loss. We talked yesterday in our talk on trauma about the woman who said, it hurts too much to love, so I'm never going to love again. Many people say, it hurts too much to move into that pain. I'm afraid I'm going to be overwhelmed. I will die. I will lose myself. It is much too scary to allow this pain. Sometimes we don't allow others to experience the pain. We try to divert them. We were talking yesterday about post-traumatic stress disorder as a disorder people after experiencing a trauma may develop. With the people that I work with, and I work with that condition a lot, I sometimes get people referred to me who have had horrendous experiences, and so their family or their doctor or their lawyers absolutely certain they need help. It was just too terrible to think about. They come to me and they tell their story and they're full of a lot of pain, but they haven't developed this anxiety disorder. And over the years, I've started to realize that there's a common theme there. People who were encouraged to talk about it early on, right after it happened, often don't move into post-traumatic stress disorder. Because PTSD is really a phobic reaction. It's like, I can't stand this, I can't look at it, I can't deal with it, and every time you push it away, it doesn't go away, it comes back even stronger. Being able to be held by my friends, my community, to stare it down, to say, that was terrible, and cry, and let the pain move through, you start to desensitize. And so people who are unwilling to look at the pain often develop a real phobic reaction to the loss itself. And then anything that's associated with it, they start to stay away from it. They don't want to look at. So a lot of the people who come to me, what we would think would have an anxiety disorder, don't. And then the folks who do come say, well, my friend said it was better not to think about it. And yet they're thinking about it all the time. They can't let it go. Often with children, too, we don't want to talk to them about loss. We think it's protecting them if we use euphemisms or if we just don't let them know what's going on. Well, you know, little children are very sensitive to the vibes, you know. They'll often, when I taught preschool years ago, three-year-old would come in and say, Mommy and Daddy are fighting and they may not live together anymore. And so when I would say to the parent, they said, how does she know that? We've never said anything. We always fight when she's asleep. Yeah, right. Kids are really perceptive. They pick it up. And if they don't know what it's about, like she was really intuitive and she knew what it was about. A lot of kids take it personally. Something's wrong with me.
Sure.
Yeah, they don't like me. They're, you know, I've been bad somehow. I want to read you a story. That happened early on in my practice. I had this couple phone me, and the mom said, Tommy's only in kindergarten, and already he has a school phobia. So I'd really like you to see him. We need to work through this right away. I said to her, has there been any major stress or loss in his life in the last while that could account for this? She says, no, nothing. You know, his life is serene. Everything is great. So, fine. So they brought him in. She said he refuses to go to school or anywhere else by himself. You know, could we bring Tommy to see you? So, in he came, and I was doing play therapy at that time. When I first saw him, Tommy was engrossed in the toys I keep in my waiting room. I introduced myself and led them into my office. I thought it would take some time to uncover his problem, as Tommy would need to become comfortable with me, but the five-year-old surprised me. As he settled himself on my sofa, I said, "Your mom says you don't like kindergarten." "Oh, I love kindergarten," said Tommy. "I love Mrs. Pearson, and I love the sand table, and I love the story time, and I love the finger painting." "That's a lot to love, Tommy," I said. "It's a puzzle, because you love all those things, yet you aren't going to school." I waited for his response while he checked out my bookcase. "Boy, you've got more books than Mrs. Pearson." Then returning to the sofa, Tommy looked at me and asked, "Didn't you hear what happened? Mommy and Daddy went to hospital, they had a baby, and they lost the baby. But they came home, and they sit on the sofa, and they cry. And I say, 'Go look for the baby.' And they say, 'It won't help, we lost the baby.' And they cry harder." Now, I don't know my way back from kindergarten. And so if I go and they lose me, they're going to sit in the sofa and cry about me, but they won't come and get me. So I'm going to wait until I'm old enough to find my way back myself.
Wow. Now that is pretty deep.
Mom says, "That's not what lost the baby means. Why didn't you ask what it means?" He drew himself up and he said, "I know what lost means. That happens in Safeway sometimes, and you say, 'Don't get lost, or I may never see you again.' So I stay close." Now, if you think you know a word and somebody uses it, you're not going to say what context you're using that word in. And a child doesn't. And so using words like lost, or I had a little child. Then after his grandmother's funeral, when they kept saying, you know, "She's at peace now, she's at peace now," at church, the next time they say, "Well, pass the peace," we hear this little voice, "No!" Maybe it's catching.
Across the name of their church is peace to the church.
You know, she's at rest. And then they wonder why the kid won't go down for the nap in the afternoon. So the words we use are really important for children and for adults. To use a word they're not going to associate with something else. And people often do that because they think that a child can't handle the pain. Well, kids are totally in the present. They hurt, and if they receive comfort and love and support, they move off. The pain moves off really quickly. We're the ones that once the pain is over, we think about the pain we've had and kind of work it up again, or we think about the pain that's to come. If we could just be in the present like children are and hurt totally when we're hurting, and then when we're not, let it go, it'd be a whole lot easier. So being willing to stay in the pain, to move into the pain, it's the best way to move through. Some people will say to me, I don't want to bond with that person or with that thing because I'm afraid of the pain if something happens. I worked a lot with bereaved parents, and when they were pregnant with a subsequent pregnancy, the mom would often say, "I'm not going to really connect with this baby until after I know she's got all her fingers and toes." And I say, you can't. It's much harder to grieve for something nebulous. If you have a relationship with someone or something, it's much easier to grieve that and to let it go. It's harder to grieve for something that's nebulous. That's why we pick symbols so much, symbols for our culture, or symbols for our home, or because that makes it easier to connect with it. Well, it's also easier then to grieve. The next one is an unwillingness to move out of the pain of loss. Now that may seem crazy to you, but there are a number of reasons people don't want to do that. And move it down, we'll just look at those three reasons. Thank you. Lots of people feel, "I deserve to suffer. I have done something wrong, right? I have caused an accident where someone has been injured, or I haven't been a good friend. or, you know, my uncle kept saying, please come and visit, and I never did. So I deserve this pain. Now, the problem often with that kind of guilt is that we never have an end of sentence. We just don't let it go. And in my book, A Path Through Loss, I tell a story about Jesse. I have a volunteer prison ministry, and he told me his story. He said he drove drunk many times, of course, had always seemed to get away with it, but one day hit Amy, and she was a 10-year-old. She wasn't killed, but she, you know, had some fractures, and it was a real wake-up call to him. He did some jail time. He did some programs. He went to AA, and he went to some other alcohol and drug programs to work through it, but he said, the guilt's still there. I still feel that there's something else I need to do. He heard of the concept of restorative justice or transformative justice, and he said to his chaplain, I'd really like to do something directly for Amy. Now, I realize that she might not want anything to do with me, but could you try to contact the family and see if they're interested in me doing something specifically to atone for what I've done? So the chaplain contacted the pastor of the family's church, and they agreed to a meeting. And in that meeting, Jesse said it was the hardest thing he did. It was worse than being in prison, because hearing little Amy say, and I was walking in the crosswalk to school, and then I looked because I heard a noise, and there were lights were coming, and it was so scary, you know, and she went through all of that, and being hit, and then being in the hospital. He heard the parents' anguish about, and at one point, Mom said, and in our small hospital, they didn't have blood for her, and we had to wait for some time. It was so scary. We didn't know if she would die or not. So that was so important for him to hear that, for them to speak it. Then he said, what can I do? And they couldn't think, you know, well, you can't go back and change things. He says, no, I can't. But something that would be for her memory. What they finally came to is that he would donate blood. Amy thought that was a really good idea, and especially when he said, well, I hate needles. At first he said, I will donate blood for the rest of my life in your name. Well, very quickly, something that is being done for reconciliation turns into a duty, and that's not good. There has to be an end of sentence. And so she came up with the idea that, well, do it 10 times because I'm 10 years old. So once he was released from prison, he started donating blood. And it also had to keep him drug-free, you know, and like, so he was much more motivated for that. After he did the 10th time, he wrote her a letter through the church that she attended and said, I've done these 10 times, these are the dates. You know, again, I'm so sorry. And then he said, and I think I'm going to continue donating blood, not for you anymore, but because I really see the need. And what it was interesting, because what it did was it started connecting him to his community in a positive way, too. As, you know, he started meeting other people who were donating blood, that he started to get involved in ways. It's not just the drinking buddies in the bar anymore. So if we could move past that, I deserve to suffer. So often, you know, someone will say to me, oh, I can't possibly be forgiven. I said, well, do you think God's not forgiving you? Oh, yeah, well, sure, God is. I said, so you're not forgiving yourself. So God's forgiving you and you're not. That's a sin. I haven't thought of it that way. Shift that around. Okay, the next one. Some people are afraid to move out of the pain because they're worried they won't have as much of a bond. That I will forget the person who has died, or I'll forget, you know, the job that was so important to me. The pain keeps it alive. what I say to people is, have you ever had, say, a toothache or appendicitis or gallstones or something, and you know the pain of that. It takes your whole attention. But it takes your attention in a very narrow, rigid way. You know, you're not going to say about this tooth that's hurting so much, "Well, this has been a great tooth for me. This tooth has really, I've all the corn this tooth has eaten over the years." It's like, deal with this thing, right? It's all negative. So the pain is keeping our attention, but it's keeping it in a very narrow, rigid way. The grieving process, if we allow it to continue, takes us to a place where that sharp pain moves off, allowing even stronger bond, richer, deeper. I can remember the good times and I can laugh. I can feel the warmth. I can, you know, open my heart to what's out. I can feel, remember the funny times, the times where that person irritated me, as well as the pain. So it's not that the pain goes completely, but it's much richer, that bond. So we actually have a closer relationship when the grieving starts to, the main pain moves off. So when I explain it in that way to people, they're often then willing to enter into, that place where they can let it go when it's ready to go. Because often we pull it back. The third one, reason people will not move out, is that they see it as a badge of honor. When I had a group for parents who had babies and young children die, this particular couple, 3 weeks after their baby had died, decided to go off for a weekend to just get away. And they went to a small island, a resort. And he said, as I was waiting in the bar for my wife to come down, and we were going to go out for dinner, I started chatting with a fellow who was sitting there. And I don't know how it happened, but almost, the first thing he said to me was, we had a child die 20 years ago. And so then he felt like he could say, our baby just died 3 weeks ago. This other fellow kind of draws himself up and he says, well, it's been 20 years, I've cried every day. See what a good parent I am. Mm. And this is it, really? And yes. And if we do that, we have pain as a badge of honor. Again, it keeps a focus in a very narrow way. He could not talk about his child without crying. It frees us to grieve, to let the pain move through. Okay, next one. Thank you. It's so nice you're doing this. Okay, let's go for these four. Another reason, and let's go all four miss them. Not many more.
All four.
Yeah, Joyce Ruff in her book "Praying Our Goodbyes," which I really like, says that often we have stuck or unresolved grief because we have a myth about God. We feel that for some reason God wants us to suffer, wants us to have the pain. She says the ones she sees most frequently are, God sends these experiences of pain and suffering out of love for us. And when I've talked to me, and some people will say that, yes, God loves me so much, I get all this suffering. And I say, well, how does that work? And he says, well, because I'm strong, I can handle it. What? Well, not efficient use of resources, I think. If we're Christ's hands in the world, and we're so much in pain that we can't function, God is punishing us for some sin by sending us suffering. So we have a sadistic God who says, gonna get you, you've been bad. God is testing our faith through pain. That's a human game, Do you love me? Prove you love me. Jesus didn't come to say that. And pain is God's will, which is beyond our understanding, so you just kind of put up with that. If instead we realize that pain is part of living, part of life, many of the experiences of pain we have are human caused, You know, and it just, it bothers me that still in life insurance policies, they'll say they don't cover acts of God. Right? Like hurricanes and tornadoes is like, I think I'll send them a hurricane. It's been pretty boring down there in Minnesota right now, you know, like. If we see God instead as a friend who is with us in our pain, in our suffering, and walks with us, offering us comfort, support, love, guidance. If we're looking for God to take it away, if I just have enough faith, it'll be taken away, then we're not open to the love and the comfort that is there and the guidance that's there. Some people say, well, the stronger I grow in my faith, the easier it will be to handle this and the less suffering or pain that I will experience. I say the more you grow in your faith, the more you live like God lives. And God lives in the pain. God lives in the suffering. In fact, you're probably going to, as you grow in your spirituality, you'll grow in your compassion. And you'll hurt more for the world. But thank goodness we don't do it alone, because as we grow in our spirituality, we grow in that knowledge, that awareness that God is with us. And so we're grieving with God. We are in pain with God. And that is such a comfort. And as Christians, having the role model of Jesus grieving, we talked a couple of days ago about what a good role model Jesus is for grief. He wept when Mary and Martha were grieving for Lazarus, where he didn't need to. He could have just said, hey, I'm going to do a miracle here. Stop feeling bad. He entered into their experience in empathy, and he grieved with them. He cried. So to remember Jesus when we're grieving, that Jesus is with us and Jesus is a role model for grief. And that God is not sending these experiences as a lesson. They're part of life. It's part of our free will, which God is passionate about. Okay, the next. Well, any, you can ask questions or make comments and disagree if you want as we go through. No? Okay. Okay.
Nancy, we had a speaker here a couple years ago who said that grief was being discussed, and she said, remember that God is the father of a murdered son.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a powerful,
yes.
In the context of the discussion, it was very powerful.
That's right.
How does God let this happen?
Yes, exactly. And in fact, you know, that is the strongest awareness that I have around God being nonviolent, is that God didn't blast the people that crucified Jesus. You know, we have no indication that those people were, you know, set upon with plagues or whatever. So, yeah, that compassion, and of course, Christ also being forgiving and compassionate. Yeah. Now, lots of people come to me and they say, I had this huge pain, this huge loss, and everybody at my church said, give it to God. So I did. But it came back. Has ever that happened to you? When you think, what's wrong with me? Yeah. Give it again. It comes back again. We have patterns that resonate with its, that attract its, that encourage its. And unless we give ourselves as well as the it for transformation, we will encourage that. I had a woman come in and say, you know, I've been in 5 relationships and I always seem to get into a relationship with the same guy. And I always promise myself afterwards, I'm not going to. You know, but it's always the same guy. And I said, the next time you go to a party, walk into the room, take a quick look around, and then either close your eyes or turn away and say to yourself, how many men are in this room? And then look back and actually count. And see which ones you just automatically zeroed in on. They're the familiar ones. And which ones you didn't even notice. and then go to them and talk to them. Because it's the familiar ones that probably are part of that pattern. You know, and she said, well, yeah, actually, that's true. She says, it's the charismatic, it's the guy that seems to have a lot of people around him, and I think, wow, he's really assertive and he's got a good self-esteem. And then I get into a relationship and I find he's so self-centered, he's not the least bit interested in me. No. We are attracted to the familiar, and often those patterns that are not real healthy. So we need to give ourselves to God. And it's interesting, we want to give the problem and we want to make some kind of sacrifice, you know, but what God asks and what through every prophet, I want your heart, I want your broken heart. Well, good, because I have a broken heart. That's great. I can give you that. But we don't want to do that. We want to do some kind of bargaining. I'll pray every day, like for 20 minutes, if you help me. Or every Sunday I'll go to church, like every Sunday. You know, we want these bargains. And, you know, it used to be, well, I'll sacrifice a sheep for you or a goat. No. Prophets say, no, I want your heart, I want your broken heart. Okay, now we got more sophisticated and we'll get into these other bargains. No, I want your broken heart. You know, when are we going to listen? And by giving God our broken heart, then the transformation can happen. And then we can be encouraged in our healing. Okay, next. Okay, this is a big one. Spiritual needs and spiritual practices change during the grieving process very frequently. And we often, in our pain, stay with kind of clenched. We don't feel real flexible. I do this as well. We stay with practices we've had before. It suddenly kind of seemed arid or dry. I did a day-long workshop on grief and spirituality for a church for their lay and professional helpers. And a woman came up to me at noon and she said, I kind of feel like a fraud. She said, because you know, I say I'm here to help other people, but, you know, I really can't, I'm not praying properly. I said, you're not praying properly? She said, no. I said, I didn't know there was a particular way to pray. She said, well, I had one that worked really well for me. It was kind of like a dance with God. You know, I'd start off with some praise, and then I'd move into some thanksgiving, and then I'd pray for everyone in the world that I think needed it, and kind of quiet. She says, but I don't get past praise now. And it's like, okay, what's it like? Well, I'm blowing it. I'm being really bad. I said, well, you're also being very judgmental about yourself. So it's hard for me to really get a sense of what's happening in your prayer. She said, well, I just want you to tell me how I can concentrate better. So I said, first I need to know what's going on. So could you try to let go of the judgment and just walk me through your prayer this morning? She says, okay. She says, well, I set the timer, get settled. She sounded like a Lutheran. Get settled in my chair. I started with some praise, and then it's like nothing, and then the timer goes off. I said, okay, let's rewind that a little bit. What was the nothing like? Oh, nothing. I said, no, stay with me. Okay. So I start with some praise, then it's nothing, nothing. Actually, you know, it's kind of restful. You know, actually, it's kind of like being held in a parent's arms. She says, huh, I guess this is what I need, she says. And I've been saying, God, I'm not doing it right. And meanwhile, God's been giving me this gift. And that happens so frequently when I talk to people. I say, I can't understand why I can't pray in this particular way anymore, or that it doesn't help to do this or that. Some people find after a loss, that they feel so vulnerable that even going to corporate worship is too hard for them to go to church. They feel so guilty about that. They either don't go and make up some excuse and feel really ashamed, or they go and feel like they're being intruded on. The music's too loud. Instead, God may be saying, just go out in the woods walking with me. Let me comfort you just in the quiet and peace of the woods. One woman came to me, and she was really having trouble because she's Pentecostal. They have pretty bouncy services. And she couldn't take, you know, more than a couple people in a room talking. It just was too jarring for her, and she couldn't take loud music. So she was having great difficulty. So we talked about it. Once she could get past the shame and the guilt of it, she agreed that she'd contact her pastor. She came back the next session, and she said that her pastor had been thinking for some time of having a midweek service that was quieter, because there were a number of people in the congregation for one reason or another. One had a traumatic head injury and couldn't take noise. You know, another said that it was just too fast for her now, that in her condition. So he said, I've been thinking about this, and you coming to me really feels like it needs to happen. And she said, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. So pastors are usually quite flexible and open to that. Communities can pray for somebody who's not with them while they're off being with God somewhere else. And that's how last week we were talking about spiritual discernment, how to know God's will for us. And very frequently, God will invite us to a particular path, but it is an invitation, it's not a demand. And when Moses was caring for his father-in-law's sheep, and he was walking along and he saw a bush burning, he moved towards it. And it says in scripture, and when the Lord saw that he'd moved towards it, he spoke to him. Okay, so we need to make that step. And then, do you remember what God said from the burning bush? Take off your shoes. The ground on which you're standing is
holy ground.
Didn't say, take off your shoes, this bush is holy. Right? Ground on which, because it's so easy when we have an experience of God to see, oh, this particular place is sacred, this particular time, and this isn't. And it would have been very easy for Moses to focus on that bush. That's God, or that's my image of God. But no, the ground you're standing on. And so God will invite us to the place that is going to help us the most, for our own healing, for our own growth. And if we feel an urge within us to go out into the woods and walk, then that's where God is going to be most powerful for us, and not necessarily in church at that particular time. So when we get rigid about our needs, our spiritual needs, you know, I want you to fix it in this way, God, we don't see where God has already fixed it. We were talking last week too about gratitude, and that often we start our discernment with thank you. You know, because maybe I've just realized I have a particular problem, but God's known about it for some time. It's not that we pray to say, woohoo, let me tell you what's going on with me. God already knows, and God's already been working on it. And so by saying thank you for what you've already done, thank you for alerting me to this, and thank you, you know, for being with me here, that orients me to hearing that still small voice, whether it's within me or whether it's through someone else or through scripture. So the rigidity, we can do some things to allow ourselves to be more receptive to God, to listen to God. Okay, let's go to the next one. There's a bit more to that. Thank you, Tom. a pre-existing pattern such as depression or anxiety can complicate the grieving process, and because we may have fewer resources for healing. Some people will say to me, I don't know why I'm grieving so intensely. And they are judgmental about themselves. And as soon as we get judgmental, we really start putting the brakes on the healing process. You know, we make it very difficult for God to get in there and transform things. And I'll say, well, what's been happening the last while for you? Oh, the last year's been terrible. You know, I lost my job, and then I had this root canal that just didn't seem to resolve. And they tell me all these things. Well, by the time the loss occurs that has brought them to me, they are exhausted emotionally and physically, mentally, maybe even spiritually. They wonder why they're reacting so strongly to this particular loss. So if we understand and can cut ourselves some slack, know that, well, an accumulation of loss may mean that I'm reacting very strongly to this one, so I really need to take it easy. I need support. Or if we do have an ongoing depression or some other disorder, that can complicate the grieving process. It doesn't, however, automatically mean that our grieving is going to be longer or deeper or more complex or difficult to move through. I did an internship on a psychogeriatric unit as part of my doctoral program. And while I was there, a patient died, and that's not common. Most people, if they became very physically ill or were terminally ill, they would be moved to a different unit. But this fellow had been in and out of the psychogeriatric unit for some years, really knew the staff, didn't have family, didn't really have friends. And so as he knew his terminal illness was getting to the point that he was going to die soon, he asked if he could stay on the unit, and they agreed. He died, and I asked the nursing staff what they were going to do, because I knew that he was known to the other patients and staff and families, and I said, are you going to have some kind of service? And I said, oh no, you know, we're afraid that their depression or their anxiety disorders or dementia will become worse if we, you know, talk about it, and so we're just going to ignore it. And I said, no. Naming something gives us a feeling of power and allows transformation, allows the healing. Ignoring it is likely going to have those other people thinking, well, I guess they don't really care about us. I could even die and they wouldn't do anything. Oh, it's, you know, we don't have the authority. So I went to the psychiatrist and I talked to him. And he agreed. He says, okay, we've not done this before, but let's do it. We connected with the chaplain and set up a short memorial service, which all of the patients came to. Most of the staff did, even the ones that were off duty, and some of the family members. And I talked a little bit about the grieving process, and I said, if you experience increased depression, know that that's not likely your clinical depression. That is a normal depression that people experience as part of the grieving process, and that many of us are going to be experiencing that. And I talked, you know, just for a couple of minutes about different symptoms. The psychiatrist was great because he said, you know, one of the symptoms Nancy talked about is poor concentration. He said, I've already been experiencing that. So if you're talking to me and I kind of lose the track of what we're saying, could you help me out? And if you see me tearing up, you know, just know it's probably because of Bruce. Later, so many patients said, oh, you know, Dr. Johnson is a person. it's great. We had one patient who had refused to be in any groups. He was really difficult about taking his medication. He just, you know, was very hostile. He sat like this most of the time.
he came, well, with a friend, you know, he came, and partway through when we had gave people a chance to say what they wanted to say, he said, I'd sometimes just go into Bruce's room and I'd sit. And Bruce was really good because he wouldn't ask me questions. We just would sit together, and sometimes he'd say something, and sometimes I'd say something. And I'm going to miss him. Well, that was more than he'd ever said in the month that he'd been there. And then we noticed that the next morning he came to the morning group. The nurses monitored it quite carefully, and there was no increase in medication in the month after. They really thought that there would need to be. And in fact, people were bringing up losses from the past that they hadn't been willing to talk about before, because now it was out in the open and somebody could talk about loss. The power of a community to be together is absolutely incredible. You know, it's so to name it and to go with it. And so often somebody who is initially saying, no, I can't deal with it for some reason, if the community will help, it really supports. I want to show you an example that happened to me. Now let's see, where, okay. My first job, this is me, after receiving a certificate in early childhood education and care in 1976, was as a preschool supervisor in a brand new daycare center. The owner, Mark Caron, would continue to supervise the half-day preschool, and my daycare would take 3 to 5-year-old children all day up to 5 days per week. It was a wonderful opportunity to put my love of young children and my new education into practice. Also, Mark was agreeable to my working for only 1 year at Gingerbread Daycare because I'd been accepted into the master's program in counseling psychology at the University of Victoria. By April, I was feeling at home with the rhythm of the day. That particular morning, we had a full group, no kids away sick. The phone rang about 9 a.m. Is this Nancy Reeves? Well, I'm calling from the university. I'm sorry to have to tell you that we've lost accreditation for the counseling program. So it will be closed for a year while restructuring is done. I went into shock. I was number eight, and they took 7. And so this year I got in. I had to ask the voice to repeat what she told me. Finally, I was able to say, you mean I can't attend university next year? That's right. I'm sorry, such late notice. I realize other universities have already chosen their students for next year. So I replaced the phone receiver and turned to see a room full of preschoolers happily going about their business of play. I've got to get it together, I thought. I have children to care for. I need to put my stuff, my own pain down until tonight when I get home. Just then, 5-year-old David left his toy and walked over to me. Nancy, you don't look very good. I felt the tears welling up and I tried to push them down. I couldn't let the kids know that I wasn't in control. It's okay, David, I just got some bad news. What was it, he asked. By this time, I'm surrounded by children. In as calm a voice as I could manage, I said, remember the school I was going to go to next year? All nodded. Well, they've just closed the school, and I won't be going. That's terrible, exclaimed David in a shocked voice. Like if we drove to Gingerbread and it wasn't there. David's concern was making it nearly impossible for me to keep my composure. So I tried to minimize my loss, right? Yep. We do that, right? Well, I'm sure things will turn out, I said. A little girl called to a friend across the room, Nancy's sad because she can't go to her school. More children left their toys and surrounded me. Oh no, I thought. I can't even escape into the bathroom for a few minutes because my assistant is outside with the rest of the group. 10 concerned faces looked up at me. I felt a small hand slip into mine. 4-year-old Teresa said, We could make muffins for snack. Makes me feel better. Another child brought me Margaret Wise Brown's book, The Dead Bird. Have you read that? And suggested that they read it to me. Amazing that they were able to make the connection between loss of opportunity and loss by death. Although they couldn't read, they knew the book by heart, and there were only a few disagreements about which words to say for each page. When the story was over, the children all shared losses they had experienced, ranging from the death of a pet to moving to a home they loved. We made muffins for snack, and when the children who were outside came in, they were told about my loss. Throughout the day, child after child would ask how I was feeling. Although their concern was comforting, I felt guilty that I was introducing my problems into their playtime. As each adult came to collect their child, I told them about the day and said I hoped that my loss had not impacted negatively on their little one. That night, I received 3 phone calls at home. The next day, the rest of the parents gave me the same message. Thank you for the gift you gave our child. He or she was so proud about being able to help you. I realized that I had been underestimating these kids. They were not burdened by my pain. They felt empowered to be of assistance when they chose. That was before I had, you know, done anything around loss, and it really showed me the power of those kids. And I ended up doing my master's thesis on death concerns in the preschool, because at that time the psychology and child care books were saying young children don't understand what death is, therefore they don't grieve. I'm like, not right. They do. They grieve for many things. They don't grieve the way an adult does often, but they do grieve, and we need to honor that. And they can be such powerful help as well.
So what did you do the next year?
So it was so weird. I started off at UBC that summer. I got in. And then UVic opened in the second week of September. Their accreditation came through quickly, and so then I switched over. It was terrible. It was a real big loss. What's the next one?
Okay. Lack of support.
Lack of support, or the wrong type of support. This one is often a cause for us closing down our grief, or grieving in a way that's acceptable to people around us, but it's not our own style. Men in particular, there's losses that are called disenfranchised loss or disenfranchised grief, because either they're not accepted as a loss, you know, grieving for a same-sex partner, society may not say you have a right to grieve. Male grief very often is disenfranchised. You know, unless you grieve like a woman, you're not seen as grieving. Or one very frequent one I had with the bereaved parents I worked with is that a man would say, I was walking down the road, met a friend who said, oh, I heard your baby died. How's your wife? You know, like you wouldn't be hurting. Disenfranchised grief. I worked with a woman who 15 years previously had her son die. She and her husband had split, and her son was grieving for the loss of his dad. He was 7 years old. And he seemed to be grieving a lot for the companionship. His dad had moved in with another woman in another city and just didn't see him very much. And as summer came, he said, I want to go camping with my dad, and he won't take me camping. Mom, who had never camped in her life, said, I'll take you. Shouldn't have done it. Went where dad had taken him the year before, which was out in the logging road. They got dropped off by friends and left. He went out playing in the lake and fell between 2 logs and was killed as they came together. Horrendous. what she had to do was get him out of the lake herself, make kind of a travois with branches, and drag him for a number of miles until some loggers driving home found them and took them into Campbell River Hospital. When she got there, and she's sitting in shock in the waiting room, this is now like some hours past, a nurse comes and says, "I don't know how you could do that, bringing him on all that way. I would have been crying the whole time. I love my child so much." Right away, she thought, "I'm a bad mother. If I was a good mother, I couldn't have done that." She needed to do that. And I believe God was there with her, giving her the strength to do that, shutting her emotions down so she could take him to hospital as quickly as possible. And yet, because that was not support, what the nurse maybe was trying to do was to get her to move out of shock and to cry and release it at that point, but it sure didn't. It didn't do. The other thing we can do is that we give ourselves the wrong kind of support. I had a woman call me. My secretary said, "I think you better take this call. She won't make an appointment, but she sounds very distraught." And this woman said, "I am in my 80s. My brother has just died. We'd lived together all our life. Neither of us married. And I'm having a difficult time. And in fact, I think I'm going to kill myself." And I said, "Well, I'd really like to see you." And she says, "No, I don't want you to meet me. I don't want you to know who I am, because if I decide to do it, I don't want you to feel bad." And I said, "Oh, great." So I said, "Well, could you tell me what the problem is?" And she said, "Yes, because I don't want to die. I really don't want to die." She said, "But we live together, and he died, and I expected one of us would it. You know, we're getting on, but his last wish, and I knew it was a very strong one, was to be cremated and to have his ashes scattered on the Olympic Peninsula." Now, she lived in Victoria, and so that in Canada, and the Olympic Peninsula is in the U.S. She said, "So we had a wonderful funeral. It was just great, and he was cremated, and I got his ashes, and I got onto the Coho Ferry and got over to the customs, and they said, 'What's your purpose in entering the United States of America?'" And she says, "Oh, to scatter my brother's ashes here and on the Olympic Peninsula." "Well, you can't do that. That's pollution. You can't bring deceased remains into our country." And they made me go back on this ferry. And she said, and that was bad enough, but my belief is that he won't rest until his last wishes are dealt with. Because I was going to say, "Well, would he know?" So what I do in situations that seem really closed is just try to open it more. And so I said, "Can you just tell me about him? Tell me about yourself. Like, I just trust that God will get in somewhere if we just open it rather than..." So I'm not gonna start coming in with suggestions that she's going to yes but me on. So she starts telling me about him and their relationship, and you know, and at one point she talks about what a good sense of humor he had. And so then at that point I said, "Now, just imagine that you were over doing that trip with him and taking a friend's ashes. What would he say to you on the way back?" "Oh, dear," the language he could use sometimes. Says, "But once he calmed down, he would have said, 'Well, we're not criminals. We're not going to try and sneak across the border. So what's the second best option?'" And I said, "And what is the second best option?" She says, "Saks Point. He loves Saks Point. That's just down the road from us. In fact, I could take a picnic lunch, and I could go, and I could scatter his ashes, and I could have a picnic. And there's always a way through. There's always a way through." if we broaden rather than close in. But when we're not supporting ourselves, or we're not letting God support us, or we're not letting others support us, then we get stuck. We have unresolved issues. So, questions, comments? You guys can dominate this.
Terminology like unresolved grief.
Yes.
And how else did they put it? Stuck
grief. Uh-huh.
The implication is that grief is bad. We've got to get rid of it.
Okay.
And and I think, in my estimation, grief is relative.
Yes.
It's not grief or this. It's like sickness and health. It's a relative thing. So the movement of grief could be, it's so dynamic, it could really assail you, and yet then later, and you might become a better person because of it.
Absolutely.
So there are some positive things.
Definitely.
And maybe we are in some situations, maybe we should, again, that's put poorly, but to grieve one's entire lifetime.
Yes, I think, in fact, we are in a chronic state of grief for our whole lives, because there's always some loss. That's not bad.
Yeah, that's what I would say. It's like Luther grieving for his child.
Absolutely.
All during his life.
Yep.
And because of that, it put him into a different kind of frame.
Yes. And especially as Christians, where the focus of the cross, that's so important. Yeah. No, my definition of grief is that it's our reactions and responses to a loss that is a healing process. Grief is a healing process. When I say stuck, I mean that we stop the process. We don't allow it to do its work of healing. And if this unresolved, that means there's an implication or a meaning that we are not naming, and therefore we can't meet our need around it. You know, like if a good friend of mine moves away and I say, well, we'll still be able to email, so, there's no reason to grieve, that doesn't honor my friend, because being face-to-face is so much different than email. If I let myself grieve for the fact that she's not, I'm not able to see her all the time now, then that makes me realize what a gift she is to me, how precious that contact is. I can honor it. So then I'm not unresolved anymore. If I'm not naming a particular need or implication or meaning, then I've got some energy taken up in holding that at bay. Oh, right, there's another group who wants to be at 7. Well, it's 1:07.
That's helpful. We need to talk about that a little bit more.
Yes.
And I was interested too in how you would handle James 1 that says, "How did all joy bring you to smile?"
Okay. Yeah, tomorrow we can do that. And you see, the first night what we did was look at the grieving process and loss and all of that. So I realized that. Okay, thank you.